Well, I want to talk about the processes through which science is done, and in particular how they should or must adapt to an unprecedented environment in which we're able to acquire extraordinary volumes of data of great complexity, able to manipulate it and to transmit it instantaneously. It's made a fundamental shift in the way in which science is done, and many of us believe we've benefited from it. The question really is, what are the impacts that data has on the way in which we do our science? It poses great challenges to us, and it also gives us great opportunities. I'm not going to talk about openness for itself, but actually how openness impacts on the way in which we do our science. But it's always useful to have a little history first, so let's try. This is Henry Oldenburg. He was the first secretary of the newly created Royal Society in the early 1660s. He was a German theologian who was an inveterate correspondent with people who we'd now call scientists in Britain, Europe, and beyond. And he had the bright idea that rather than maintain his correspondence private, why didn't he make it public? Why didn't he publish it? And he persuaded the Society to do exactly that. But his correspondence, he required two things. First of all, he required that they should write in the vernacular and not in Latin. And secondly, and crucially, he required that if they were to pose concepts in their correspondence, then those concepts must be associated with the evidence, that is to say, the data on which they were based. That last, in particular, permitted others to scrutinize the logic of the argument, the coherence of the evidence, permitted them the opportunity to explore the evidence, make similar observations, explore the evidence, explore the logic of the argument. And it's been argued by historians of science that concurrent publication of both concept and evidence in open and accessible ways was one of the key building blocks which enabled the scientific revolutions of the 18th and 19th centuries. And of course, openness is probably the most fundamental form of peer review. Pre-publication peer review is important, but actually it's what happens after you've published that's absolutely crucial. And Oldenburg very nicely underlined why this mattered. And of course, we're now faced with this extraordinary and overwhelming data storm in recent years. Oldenburg's world has changed fundamentally. What impacts have those changes had? Well, in my view, they have created a tremendous challenge for us and also an opportunity. This is from a paper in Nature published just over a year ago, in which a group of American researchers took the top 50 benchmark papers in preclinical oncology and attempted to replicate the results. They were only able to do so in 11% of the cases. The reasons were that they were unable to do so in 89% of the cases were that the data wasn't provided, or inadequate data was provided, or inadequate metadata, data about data, was provided, such that replication simply wasn't possible. In a sense, it represents an abrogation of the principle that Oldenburg introduced, that concept and data must be concurrently published. Why don't we do that? Well, we don't do it simply because it's become too difficult. And we have been very slow to ensure that we do what we should do, and that is to ensure that electronic publication of data takes place concurrently with the publication of the concept. But of course, there's far more data that's now being created routinely by scientists globally than ever finds its way into a publication. What about all the other data that exists rather than that which simply supports publications? This is a little map of a series of databases in cognate areas that was created a few years ago. Doesn't really matter what the individual labels say, but the challenge and the opportunity is that we might well be able to utilize the links between that data to understand patterns in nature and in society in a much more fundamental way than we currently do. But it's not merely a question of saying, can we draw out those databases from Google and somehow compare them. But the question is, can we integrate the data in such a way that rather fundamental logical connections are made between different parts of it? It's an extraordinary opportunity that we are enabled, if we're able to do so, to grasp, provided we can solve a series of technical problems and provided that we can ensure that the data that so many create is accessible. There's also a problem of the way in which we treat data in this new data world. I was brought up in the view of science that was an experimentally based view. I created a hypothesis. I did an experiment to explore whether that hypothesis might satisfy my experiment. And on the whole, that logic has been sustained. It's now the case that if you have a sufficiently complex database, the probability is that you will find in there patterns which appear to replicate patterns in the hypothesis that are generated by your hypothesis. But that's a flawed logic. The fundamental question we need to ask of complex data systems is, what are the intrinsic patterns that are there, rather than can I find something that will somehow fit my pattern? Jim Gray, quoted here, is a modern data science guru who says, look, we do terrible things with our data. Somehow we need to pull back into this domain the skills of statisticians, but statisticians who address a world of much greater complexity than was once the case. And of course, we need a new breed of informatics trained and statistically competent data scientists. We need that largely because many of us who pursue our specific disciplinary objectives rarely have the skills that are either computational skills or statistical skills to be able to understand, explore, and treat our data in ways that are logically valid and appropriate. If, however, we are going to see data shared on a much bigger scale than has hitherto been the case, and in an effective and efficient way, then essentially we need to persuade scientists that it's in our interest to share our data and to exploit the opportunities that large data volumes give us, rather than hug our own personal data to our chest. There are some areas of science where that's happened. This is an example from bioinformatics, which the community has for itself begun to discover that there are ways in which they can collaborate which are not like the ways that most of us were familiar with, where the concept that most of us would have was that the data was ours rather than being community data funded by taxpayers, of which we are merely short-term custodians. And they have now developed systems in Europe which are hoping to exploit the vast data volumes that a large and complex community can create. One of the advantages, of course, they have is that they're a relatively new science and are not burdened by the assumptions that many of us in more traditional disciplines are subject to. Some of the benefits of doing things this way have been recently illustrated with considerable power. Some of you will remember only, I think, 2 years ago, there was an outbreak of a very severe gastrointestinal infection, which had considerable capacity both to spread and to infect. And there was an extraordinary mobilization of laboratories, of over 20 laboratories on 4 continents, that were able to share data in ways that permitted the infection to be typed in ways that otherwise would have been much more time-consuming and longer, and deliver into the hands of public health authorities internationally the sorts of knowledge which they require in order to be able to create sensible strategies. And of course, if we consider some of the global challenges which we now believe we should all address in a fundamental way, then inevitably those require a global response. And data sharing must be at the base of such an enterprise. Sharing in interesting new ways now is enabled by the fact of instantaneous community to the internet. This is one example. This is Tim Gowers, a Fields Medalist mathematician, who about 4 years ago put on his blog site an idea he had for the solution of a long-standing mathematical problem. He had a tremendous response of over 25 people who suggested ideas, ways in which we might approach the problem. Those contributions were either rapidly developed or quickly discarded, and after about 30 days, Tim concluded that they'd solved not only the problem that he'd set, but a much more difficult generalization of it. To the extent his comment was, it's like driving a car, whilst normal research is like pushing it. So why don't we do this more frequently? And the answer, very simply, of course, is that the criteria for credit and promotion are ideally your single author paper, which is referred to on the front pages of Nature, inhibits this sort of collaboration. And indeed, what if we're going to permit this sort of thing to happen more, we need to think much more fundamentally about diverse ways of giving credit to scientists and stimulating diverse ways of doing science in more efficient ways. And of course, there's a changing social context. You'll excuse the gentleman on the right. That is sand into which he's putting his head. But we're all aware that now there are many citizens who are no longer prepared simply to listen to the obiter dicta of scientists. They want to know the evidence which underpins scientific conclusions which have important implications both for the lives of individuals and society. And on the left-hand side, through the so-called citizen science movement, then we're beginning to find that there are ways in which the old division between the professional and the amateur can be overridden, and interesting collaborations are taking place that in very many areas of science in which amateur scientists who may not have had a scientific education are beginning to become involved. And who knows what might happen in the medium to long term to the social dynamic of science. These things could have a profound effect. And my view is very simply that we should do those things at the moment which somehow encourage this sort of involvement and engagement. One of the other important issues that relates to the release of data that supports publication is reflected by this headline from the Guardian blog site, "Scientific Fraud is Rife, Science is Broken." And of course, I suspect we all understand why that might be true, and that is that the rewards for doing high-profile science, producing novel and apparently important discoveries are so great that people are tempted to go to extremes in doing what they do. There are now far too many cases of data which has been invented to support particular concepts, and the crucial systemic response to that ought to be to make that data open such that it can be scrutinized, and hopefully fraudulent data will both be deterred on the one hand and is more susceptible to discovery on the other. We, I think, would like to think that over the next few years we might identify a series of behaviours which are not uncommon as malpractice, that the non-publication of evidence for a published claim really ought to be regarded as malpractice. Many of us are not really aware when we're cherry-picking our data. Sometimes we do it with malice aforethought. Sometimes we do it because actually we're making logical errors. And we need to be very careful about doing that. All the data should be there. Partial or biased reporting can be serious. It disrupts the connection between cause and effect, and many have argued very cogently that the area of clinical trials is an area which needs to be reformed in relation to biased reporting. And of course, one of the things that we see rather clearly is that many journals are rather averse to the publication of refutation, largely because, of course, something that purports to be an exciting new discovery seems to be much more print-worthy than something which is merely a rather dull refutation, a beautiful theory being destroyed by an ugly fact. But openness of itself really has no value. We argue that what is required is what we call intelligent openness. The data and the metadata have got to be accessible. You've got to be able to find it. They've got to be intelligible. You've got to be able to understand it. They've got to be accessible. You might want to ask questions such as, does this person have any, say, financial interest in a particular outcome? And it needs to be reusable. And we would argue that only when those criteria are fulfilled are data properly open, And those ought to be the criteria which are utilised by funding councils and by others as the basis for evaluating openness. But openness, of course, has got to be audience sensitive. If we were to do this with all the data that's produced by all our research, science would stop tomorrow. We'd all be busy creating metadata and background information that our fellow citizens can comprehend. We've somehow got to make sure that this is a nuanced process. And my view, at least, is that we ought to define an area which we might call public interest science, where we really concentrate on doing these things for our fellow citizens. But my most recent information about the seismic properties of the Antarctic ice sheet are probably less important in that domain. But, of course, there are boundaries. We argue that openness should be the default position, but there must be and should be exceptions for commercial interests. But it's important to note that there are great sectoral variations. The business model in some areas favours open data. In other areas, it most certainly doesn't. Privacy is important. And apart from the mathematical demonstration that complete anonymization of anything other than relatively trivial data sets really implies that somehow we've got to think of safe data. In other words, the way in which data can be utilized by bona fide researchers but actually isn't available for those who might have a slightly more malign intent. Safety, security, dual use in particular, but if you follow the arguments that have taken place over dual use in relation to agents which might be able to cross the species boundary in the last year, you'll realize that the arguments are complex. And all those boundaries are fuzzy boundaries. If you asked a lawyer to sit down and write a document which would define those boundaries, you'd probably find yourself you had a thousand-page document. So where do the responsibilities lie? What actions do we need in order to mobilize science in the directions that we've indicated? First of all, we scientists have got to think of the data that we acquire as a consequence of public funding for science is not our data, but we are, if you like, its custodians. The learned societies have a role to play simply because they represent both the priorities and the principles which underlie many disciplines. Universities and institutions have particularly difficult problems. I mentioned already incentives in relation to promotion criteria. There are many other things too. Funders of research need to mandate intelligent openness, and equally publishers who are the ultimate gatekeeper need to move to a position where they too regard the publication of the data as a necessary prerequisite for the publication of the concept. There have been a great number of actions in recent months at several levels. Internationally, some of you will know of the G8 statement about principles of open data. An enterprise called the Research Data Alliance has been developed involving the US, the UK, and a number of other key research intensive countries. So a frame and a shift of perspective is taking place internationally. But if that is to be realized, it needs to be realized on the ground through the involvement of those people who actually understand the mechanisms that are at stake. In Europe, the Horizon 2020 has accepted open data as a key principle for the work that it will fund, and European bodies have been engaged. In the UK, a series of bodies have been involved in discussing these sorts of issues. And the Ministry of Science has created a Research Data Transparency Board. We have been discussing in this society whether somehow we should attempt to either persuade others or stimulate the creation of some sort of forum for those interested parties who need to play a role in making practicality work on the ground. This attempts to spread this issue more broadly in relation to this phrase that one frequently sees used, open science. And we would categorize it into three parts. On the left-hand side, the input to the scientific enterprise, collecting the data, doing the research. And increasingly, of course, many of us have been advocating means whereby science is done increasingly openly in the public eye. In terms of open data, there are really three categories, that which I've been speaking about, which is largely research data, but also, of course, there's administrative data, which is held by government, and many of you will have seen it public, administrative data
task force report earlier this year. And then, of course, there's public sector research data produced by bodies such as the Met Office. On the right-hand side, we have the whole business of open access publication and access to the outputs of research. I would say that the title of our little report when we began was not Science as an Open Enterprise, but Science as a Public Enterprise. And I do think that, in a sense, this spectrum reflects that. We decided that Science as a Public Enterprise was too complicated, too difficult, and too soon, so we'd do data to make it easier. But there are some things that can be done and can be done quickly, and practitioners, I think, might understand the potential impacts they have. One of them is simply this one, and that is there is a realizable aspiration that we might make all the scientific literature online, all the data open and online, and for them to and for the two to interoperate. That's an achievable objective in a small number of years if the appropriate pressures are applied and the creativity of the scientific community and others is mobilized. But as we say in Scotland, in relation to political devolution, this is a process, not an event. Will we ever arrive there? The answer is no, we won't, because technology will keep on pulling us forward. We would simply argue, I think, that actually we have some catching up to do, so let's catch up. Thank you.